Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 322, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on August 26th of the year 2001. In Side 1 of this broadcast, or at the end of Side 1 of this broadcast, we took a look at an allegation that surfaced in the Hamburger Abendblatt, that 17 U.S., quote, instructors, unquote, basically in all likelihood, if this allegation is correct, and I suspect that it may very well be, although I cannot confirm that, but it alleged that there were 17 American, quote, advisors, unquote, in all likelihood, operating on behalf of elements of the U.S. intelligence system, and in all likelihood working to destabilize Macedonia, perhaps as a justification for putting in NATO forces, and perhaps projecting NATO forces even farther into the Balkans and into former areas of Soviet and or communist influence, perhaps to make sure that those areas do not revert. That last is conjecture. That Hamburger Abendblatt article is available at the website www.ok.org. MK/news, about which I know nothing, that particular website, so that should not be taken as an endorsement for any other material on the website, nor should it be taken as a knock. By the way, the article was headlined Hamburger Abendblatt. Actually, the article was headlined U.S. advisors were helping the Albanian rebels. I incorrectly read that headline. It may very well be that British intelligence is also helping the Albanian rebels in the former Macedonia. Certainly, there appear to be British mercenaries involved on behalf of the Albanian National Army, and one of the possibilities that must be seriously considered is that these, quote, mercenaries, unquote, are actually fighting there on behalf of perhaps MI6 or some other element of British intelligence, and again, that is conjectural. Research credit on this also goes to a member of the listening audience. This comes from Scotland on Sunday, and specifically this is from Scotland on Sunday Online from Wednesday, July 18th of the year 2001. This is available on the website. Actually, this is the Scotsman's website. This is www.scotlandonsunday.com/world. And Scotland on Sunday had this headlined, British fighters seek thrill of battle in Macedonia's struggle. It's from Conall Urquhart in Skopje. That gentleman's name, Conall Urquhart. And once again, this is from Scotland on Sunday, July 15th of the year 2001. Again, the website, www.scotlandonsunday.com/world. The article reads in part as follows. Former British soldiers are fighting the Macedonian security services as part of the ethnic Albanian National Liberation Army, Scotland on Sunday has learned. Sources within the NLA confirmed that 12 British nationals were fighting with them in the Kumanovo region, along with at least two Dutchmen and a German. The fighters are not of Albanian descent, but are believed to have fought in some of the wars in the former Yugoslavia, including Croatia, Bosnia, and Kosovo. The British contingent was based around the village of Slupčane, and I may be mispronouncing that, until the ceasefire, which has been in place for over a week. NLA commanders are taking advantage of the ceasefire to rest their troops and send them to Kosovo to recuperate. Macedonians already feel persecuted by the Europeans and the United States, whom they accuse of encouraging the NLA. Senior Macedonian officials said they were aware that the NLA also included European former KLA fighters. Quote, we know they are there, but they are not significant. And again, one wonders whether that is in fact an accurate assessment. Once again, some of the heritage of some of the Muslim military and political formations in the Balkans goes back to a couple of Muslim Waffen-SS divisions, the 13th and 21st Waffen-SS divisions, recruited by Haj Amin al-Husseini, about whom we spoke in the first half of the broadcast. Some of the fascist collaborationist elements among Middle Eastern nationalist movements and among the Arab oil-producing elements in the Middle East, some of the fascist heritage has manifested itself on this side of the Atlantic as well. We've spoken in numerous broadcasts, most recently in For the Record 315, about Osama bin Laden, whose father Mohammed bin Laden was very close to King Ibn Saud, the founder of modern Saudi Arabia, who was himself a fascist collaborator, having worked actively with the Third Reich, with British fascist St. John or Jack Philby. He also worked very closely with Alan Dulles, who in turn was a close financial and political collaborator of the Bush family, and George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush Sr. were both heavily involved with some of the American corporations that helped to fund Nazi Germany, that discussed in numerous broadcasts available from Spitfire. In For the Record program number 311, dealing with, most recently in For the Record program number 315, called Not So Fortunate Son, dealing with the death of an alleged drug overdose of J.H. Hatfield, we dealt with Osama bin Laden and the connections between Osama bin Laden and Arbusto Energy, those connections being specifically a fellow named James R. Bath, who put forth a portion of the venture capital that went to start up Arbusto Energy, George W.'s first oil venture. James R. Bath had strong connections to the BCCI milieu and was also the Texas business representative for the bin Laden family. And I have speculated about possible connections, not possible connections, but about a possible alliance between the George Bush faction of our political and national security establishments and the bin Laden elements in the Middle East, and speculated that, among other things, the attacks on the U.S. embassies at the same time as Bill Clinton was undergoing his impeachment ordeal, and the bombing of the USS Cole, which took place at the height of the U.S. presidential campaign, and along with rising oil prices and dropping stock prices, helped to make the election a lot closer than it would have been. George Bush couldn't have stolen the election if it hadn't been close, and I've speculated on numerous broadcasts, most recently in number 315, about the possibility that the bin Laden group may have done the Cole, so to speak, in order to deliberately weaken Bill Clinton and, by extension, the Democrats, by making the Democrats look weak. A similar pincers movement was seen in 1980 when the hostage crisis and the October surprise, along with the quote, gas crisis, unquote, and the oil shortage and rising petroleum prices, helped to deep six Jimmy Carter when George Bush was running for vice president in 1980. That was George the First, by the way. Once again, the investigation into the bombing of the USS Cole has run into obstructions. In past For the Record programs, I've talked about the fact that John O'Neill, who was investigating the Cole bombing on behalf of the FBI, was denied access to Yemen in the investigation. It would also appear that John O'Neill, due to his own carelessness, or perhaps due to the activity of some other intelligence-related element, perhaps looking to destabilize the FBI in order to justify a change at the top, and we've now seen that with a Bush ally connected to the BCCI and Noriega investigations. Mr. Mueller is now head of the FBI. I would also note that John O'Neill is now under investigation for having lost track of a suitcase that, among other things, detailed all of the intelligence operations that the FBI was involved in the New York area. The following is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Sunday, and this would be August 19th of the year 2001. This is an article by David Johnston of the New York Times, the Stateline, Washington, headlined, FBI terror expert lost track of top secret. And I believe that this is cut off here. I believe the headline talks about the top secret documents, but the paper was torn here. But in any case, page A8 of the San Francisco Chronicle, Sunday, August 19th of 2001. The article reads in part as follows. The FBI has begun an internal investigation into one of its most senior counterterrorism officials, who lost track of a briefcase containing highly classified information last year. The briefcase contained a number of sensitive documents, including a report outlining virtually every national security operation in New York, government officials said. The official, John O'Neill, 49, is the special agent in charge of national security in the FBI's New York office. The job is among the most powerful in the FBI, and although O'Neill is not widely known, he has overseen cases like the terrorist bombing of the Navy destroyer Cole in Yemen last year and the bombings of American embassies in East Africa in 1998. I would note that both of those bombings apparently perpetrated by the bin Laden forces, and there are direct connections between the bin Laden forces, and the Bush forces. So I have more questions than answers about that missing briefcase. Could it have been perhaps aimed at compromising Mr. O'Neill, further embarrassing the already seriously embarrassed FBI in order to warrant pro-Bush changes within that institution? Was it perhaps aimed at finding out just what the FBI has learned about possible connections between the Bushes and the Bush forces and the Bin Laden forces? That is an article about which I have more questions than answers, but it is a disturbing article indeed. In addition to the sinister, there has also been the ridiculous in the news lately, and one of the most ridiculous things concerns some of the recent spoutings by Gore Vidal on behalf of none other than Timothy McVeigh. And Gore Vidal, something of a darling to the so-called progressive forces, has begun lionizing Timothy McVeigh, with whom he'd been conversing or been corresponding for a number of years. And Gore Vidal has been claiming that Timothy McVeigh is something of a hero, and is actually, although it's not mentioned in the article I'm about to read, he's been comparing Timothy McVeigh with Paul Revere and John Brown, all of which would go to simply confirm further the view that many have of Gore Vidal as one of the ranking twits of American letters. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who got this from the London Times. This is from the London Times of Wednesday, August 8th of 2001. It's by James Bone in New York, and headlined, "Vidal casts McVeigh as a hero," and this reads in part as follows. Gore Vidal, publishing the first extracts of his death row correspondence with Timothy McVeigh, has described the executed Oklahoma City bomber as a hero and cast doubt on whether he acted alone. Many people, myself included, do not think he acted alone, but Vidal has been claiming that McVeigh was innocent and that he is a hero. Skipping down, "Although I have many observations that I'd like to throw at you, I must keep this letter to a practical length, so I will mention just one. If federal agents are like so many Jacobins at war with the citizens of this country, and if federal agencies daily wage war against those citizens, then should not the Oklahoma City bombing be considered a counterattack rather than a self-declared war? Would it not be more akin to Hiroshima than Pearl Harbor?" Unquote. Vidal, whose historical fiction displays a penchant for conspiracy theories, seems won over by McVeigh's logic. And this is actually McVeigh's letter to Vidal. Skipping down, quote, "The abolition of slavery or the preservation of the Union would have been more worthy of his life than anger at the excess of our corrupt secret police." Unquote. By the way, Timothy McVeigh was a very obviously pro-white supremacist, although he has been cast in many modes since the bombing, and has actually emerged as something of a hero to many. I think the available evidence concerning Oklahoma City suggests overwhelmingly that there was a wider plot, and that that has been actively covered up. Oklahoma City has tended to be drastically oversimplified by most of the people who have analyzed it, and I think that much of that simplistic and to a large extent inaccurate analysis of what is actually a very complex event has been proto-fascistic in nature, and frankly I would describe the lionization of Timothy McVeigh and the turning of Timothy McVeigh into some sort of a folk hero by Gore Vidal, never an individual who has been overly long in the smarts department. I would describe that sort of lionization, comparing McVeigh with John Brown and Paul Revere, I would describe that as proto-fascistic, although it's frankly typical of much of the nonsense that's emerged in the so-called progressive sector in the last several years. Speaking of the ridiculous and things that should be ridiculous but are sadly true, in the recent debate about cloning human beings, a representative of the Raelians, a woman named Brigitte Beausoleil, actually testified on the floor of Congress. The accounts of that were carried in the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, August 8th of the year 2001. This is an article by Edward Epstein of the Chronicle's Washington Bureau. It's headlined, "Cloning Clash," and it reads in part as follows. Human cloning is now probably just a matter of time, and an Academy panel heard yesterday from three renegade scientists vying to be the first to do it. The mainstream scientists, most of whom are involved in stem cell research aimed at treating a variety of diseases, urged caution, warning that cloned babies could be born with horrible birth defects. But the advocates of cloning human babies for those who want to create their own genetic copies were unimpressed. Quote, "If you want to have a baby using your own genes, it's your right," said Brigitte Beausoleil, director of Clone Aid, a Bahamas group working toward cloning humans. Clone Aid is associated with the Raelian Revolution, a group that says life on Earth was originally created by extraterrestrials through cloning. The movement also claims that these space creatures have delivered messages to Rael, the alias for a French ex-race car driver who founded the movement, and that Jesus Christ was resurrected through advanced cloning technique. Boisselier is a bishop in the group who claims 84,000 members worldwide. And in For the Record program number 68, among other broadcasts, as well as a lecture about the political implications of the ET myth and the UFO question, I dealt with the Raelians and some of their proto-fascistic social philosophy. They have changed their symbol. It used to be a symbol in which they had a Star of David with a swastika inside, a very interesting symbol to be manifested allegedly by extraterrestrials. And the National Academy of Science is actually heard testimony from Brigitte Boisselier. This was not actually on the floor of Congress, but that is a very interesting person indeed. We've now got a spokesman for the Raelians giving a testimony before official bodies weighing in on cloning in the United States. Another example that the sublime and the ridiculous and the truly horrifying are merging here in the United States. That actually is becoming sort of perhaps the keystone of American culture and American society as we move into the years of W. One of the more eloquent and prescient analyses of the early months of the reign of George II was carried in the consortium or on the consortium's website. The consortium is in fact a journalistic consortium. They put out IF magazine in hard copy. You can visit their website at www.consortiumnews.com. And Robert Perry, P-A-R-R-Y, wrote this article for the Consortium News. It's available on their website. This is from August 9th of the year 2001, and research credit on this goes to a member of the listening audience. This is titled, A Time to Earn This, and it reads as follows. Near the end of Steven Spielberg's World War II epic Saving Private Ryan, Captain John Miller, played by Tom Hanks, lies dying, wounded after a desperate battle to defend a bridge in Normandy. He signals to Private James Ryan to come close and whispers a final message. Earn this, Miller tells the young soldier. Earn it. The admonition seems harsh. In the movie, Ryan, played by Matt Damon, had lost his brothers in the Normandy invasion and had fought bravely himself. He chose to stay with his unit to defend the bridge rather than leave his post for safety when Miller's patrol arrived to save him. Like many real soldiers who served in World War II, the fictional Ryan would seem to have done more than his fair share in the defense of his country and in the battle against tyranny. Yet the message from a dying Captain Miller to the young Private Ryan was, "Earn this," unquote. What a difference a generation or two can make. As the U.S. today stumbles through one of the greatest affronts to its democratic principles, last year's overturning of the popular choice for president, the political and media forces that enabled those events are unchastened. Many on the losing side also seem to have learned little from the experience. 6 months after George W. Bush moved into the White House, the political media dynamic that paved his way has grown even stronger. Conservative influence continues to expand over all forms of communications, from newspapers, books, and magazines, to television networks, talk radio, and well-funded websites. Along with its rightward drift, the national news media has gotten goofier, meaner, and more disconnected from any larger sense of decency. The creepy obsession with Chandra Levy's disappearance is only the most recent example of the media's skewed judgment. The punditry's insistence that Bush is doing a great job is another. Even as the economy sinks, the budget surplus disappears, traditional U.S. allies are up in arms, and potential enemies are growing closer in defiance of U.S. policies. Yet as the conservatives smartly invest billions of dollars in their own media and draw the mainstream press ever more in that direction, the primary liberal response has been to launch a few homegrown websites. While individuals have shown spunk in creating aggressive news outlets such as SmirkingChimp.com and MediaHorrorsOnline.com, the websites remain a proverbial drop in the bucket when compared to the size and sophistication of the conservative effort. Wealthy liberals mostly have stayed on the sidelines. After the election, Barbara Streisand issued a manifesto calling for a Democratic-oriented TV outlet to counter the conservative media. She also wanted Democratic politicians to show more spine. Yet, when her proposal encountered derision from the Washington Post and other bastions of national journalism, she backed down. Further to the left, Ralph Nader and his supporters remain in denial about their misjudgment in Election 2000 when they insisted there was no meaningful difference between Republicans and Democrats. In just 6 months, Bush has shattered that myth by proving the obvious, that within the extraordinary might of the U.S. government, the shades of gray in policies as well as in the competence of the leaders can be vitally important. Indeed, those shades of gray can make the difference between whether life on this planet continues or doesn't. As Bush has shown, a president has the power to sabotage international cooperation on key environmental issues such as global warming, and to touch off a new arms race by backing away from treaties on nuclear and biological weapons. The White House also can begin dismantling the traditional forms of Social Security, Medicare, and a host of other domestic policies that are important to many Americans. Despite this freshly demonstrated reality, Nader still won't admit that his white male-dominated presidential campaign might have been wrong, and the 90% of African-American voters who backed Gore might have been right. The performance of leading Democrats has been mixed. Senator Tom Daschle and a few others did orchestrate the narrow Democratic takeover of the Senate, giving the Democrats a chance to advance some of their agenda items, such as the Patients' Bill of Rights. But other key Democrats, such as Vice President Al Gore, slipped into the reeds. In his self-imposed silence, Gore avoided confronting Bush at a time when millions of Americans were looking for someone with stature to show leadership. And then Robert Perry goes on to bash Al Gore here for not standing up to George Bush. Personally, I don't think that's necessarily fair. For one thing, after the way the media ripped Al Gore and for their incredibly slanted coverage, not only of the campaign itself, but of the actual stealing of an election, I personally can't blame Al Gore for being reticent. The fact of the matter is, if he came out and was the sort of leader that many have faulted him for not being, then he would have been labeled a sore loser or worse. In fact, Richard Cohen of the Washington Post openly called for Al Gore to concede the election to George Bush, saying that Al Gore wasn't the type of person to draw us together. We need a uniter, not a divider, and that uniter was George Bush. Within months, that same Richard Cohen was faulting Al Gore for having remained silent in the face of George Bush's wickedness, and that, frankly, is classic hypocrisy on the part of Richard Cohen. So I don't really think that this is... The criticism here of by Perry is fair under the circumstances. Skipping down, he does, however, note that Gore is typical in some ways. Like many other prominent liberals, Gore resists the conclusion that the Washington Press Corps is approaching moral, ethical, and professional bankruptcy. The positive liberal view of the press comes from the past, a quarter century ago when reporters exposed serious crimes of state and the Watergate scandal, the Pentagon Papers, and the secret records of the CIA. Similarly, Gore put his faith in the court system and the rule of law during the Florida recount battle. He discouraged his backers from taking to the streets, even as the Bush campaign flew right-wing hooligans to Florida to mount violent demonstrations. To the bitter end, Gore professed to believe that the U.S. Supreme Court would defend the fundamental right to vote in America rather than simply render a partisan judgment. He was wrong in his assessment. Gore's efforts to ingratiate himself with the establishment have gained him little. He certainly won no favor from his media tormentors, who are now ridiculing his not-so-unusual decision to grow a beard on a summer vacation. In a reprise of the wacky elite journalism that characterized last year's campaign, New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd seized on the beard as a way to peer again into Gore's psyche. And Perry goes on, "The beard is magnifique," Dowd wrote. "So continental, so Pepe Le Pew. In all those pictures from Europe, the newly hirsute Al Gore, looking like Orson Welles, strolls contentedly after a repast in Rome with Tipper. He has a sly, freshly liberated expression that you usually see only on guys of 18 when they're finally old enough to escape from their parents, principals, and guidance counselors, go off on a trek to Europe, and grow a goofy-looking beard." Quote, "With his Hemingway growth and Heineken girth, all Mr. Gore needs is a pack of Gitan and an earth-tone beret," unquote. In her clever writing style and her emphasis on the personal, Dowd has become the avatar of the new hip, nihilistic press coda that, quote, "nothing is everything and everything is nothing," unquote. She is a columnist who holds dearest the belief that a smartly turned phrase is the height of the journalistic experience. Though Dowd holds a Pulitzer Prize for her commentary, her tendencies are really not so different from the TV pundits who less eloquently mocked Gore for his beard. ABC's This Week simply showed a photo of Gore's beard as the pundits uttered comments like "a gray beard" and "Al Gore, what do you make of this?" and dissolved into laughter. Nor is the silliness over Gore's beard very far from the repellent TV obsession over Chandra Levy's disappearance. On August 1st, in a classic sequence, the major TV news networks made a madcap dash of helicopters and satellite trucks to Fort Lee, Virginia, south of Richmond. The spare-no-expense race was in reaction to an anonymous tip published on a website that the body of the missing intern had been, quote, shrink-wrapped, unquote, and buried in a Fort Lee parking lot. The next day, the tip turned out to be a hoax, but the network still broadcast live stand-ups from Fort Lee. Fox News, the conservative news network that has devoted hours and a day to the Chandra Levy case, even consulting psychics, did its Fort Lee updates under the slogan, Fox on Top, unquote. The pretense behind the media's interest in Levy's disappearance was always a heartfelt concern to help her parents find their missing daughter. It was a fortunate byproduct that the disappearance gave the TV news shows a chance to gossip about the young woman's sexual affair with Representative Gary Condit, Democrat of California. The Chandra Levy case also brought the old cast from the Monica Lewinsky scandal back in force. With conservatives Barbara Olson, The Chandra Levy case also brought the old cast from the Monica Lewinsky scandal back in force, with conservatives Barbara Olson, Ann Coulter, and William Bennett reprising their roles as the nation's moral arbiters. In one dissonant question, CNN interviewer Larry King asked Bennett about hypocrisy on the part of the Republicans who had embraced Condit as a conservative blue dog Democrat before the Chandra scandal and then disowned him. Bennett, the author of the book The Death of Outrage, explained the moral relativism. Quote, look, hypocrisy is better than no standards at all, unquote. That from CNN of July 10th of 2001. As the Chandra obsession wore on, some media defenders argued that the intensive coverage was driven by the summer news doldrums. But the explanation didn't wash, since other news events were underway in Washington, as Bush pushed a wide range of policy initiatives and the Democrats countered with some of their own. On Capitol Hill, however, it was Condit's arrival at routine committee hearings that brought newsflash interruptions of regular programming. Round-the-clock Chandra coverage also couldn't be dismissed as some seasonal aberration, since similar stories had become the national news media's preferred fare year-round. If not Chandra, then JonBenet or Monica or Marv Albert or OJ or Princess Di or some other celebrity to serve as fodder for the cable news talk shows. And skipping down still further, in recent years, it has become increasingly clear that the Washington news media is more concerned about demographics than democracy. It's a different time and ethos from the one depicted in Saving Private Ryan. 57 years ago, American soldiers were battling their way across Europe, contributing to the end of one of history's most tyrannical regimes. That victory gave rise to democratic aspirations around the world, fueling the hope that all nations might finally accept the founding American principle that governments must derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. At the end of Saving Private Ryan, the scene of Ryan on the bridge in France merges into the face of Ryan as an old man. He has returned to Normandy and searched out the gravestone of Captain Miller. Fighting back tears, Ryan says he has tried to live a good life and has thought every day about Miller's admonition to earn this, unquote. He says it is his greatest hope that, quote, I've earned what all of you have done for me, unquote. And indeed, I think those are words we all need to take to heart. That concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 322, being recorded on August 26th of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.